session number 9902, reel 4.
Well, really, you see, it was a case of getting orders from Chongqing. Chongqing was collecting the revenues for the whole of China.
Chongqing would have been the seat of government now.
It was now the seat of government because they'd gone right up the Yangtze so the Japanese couldn't get at them. They couldn't get past the Yangtze gorges. And so Chongqing was the most important wartime capital at that time while we were in Fuzhou. And the Japanese Navy were patrolling the channel between Formosa and Fuzhou. And we were told not to get into the hands of the Japanese because Gordon was too important. And that we had not to be made prisoner. I mean, all the people in Shanghai by now had been made prisoner and been put into special camps.
Even Europeans?
Oh, yes. I must lend you the book about this episode. It's called Red Sun Over Shanghai or something like that. It's really the standard book on it. It's by a man called Ballard.
And this would have been before the outbreak of war, before Pearl Harbor?
This was... I'm not quite sure. I know that the little boy who's telling the story in Shanghai was in love with the Japanese planes. He thought the Japanese Air Force was his idea of what power meant. And he was a little choir boy in Shanghai. It's really a very interesting story. It is told from a little boy's point of view.
Yes, but if I could ask you, from your own, what your own knowledge was, did you know...
I didn't know about this.
You didn't know.
Until now.
Yes, I see.
Since the
yes.
publication of this book about little boy's story of the Japanese camps.
I was just wondering, about the treatment of Europeans in places like Shanghai and Fuzhou before we were at war, the British were at war with the Japanese.
Well, you see, I was at an American house, the American consul's house, when the Japanese were peacefully coming into Fuzhou. And the American consul said to me, "Oh, you getting ready to drag us into the war as you did last time?" I mean, the First World War. I said, "Nothing of the kind. I can do nothing, as you know, and you can do nothing. The Japanese are in control here, and I know they've come in peacefully, and they're calling on you and using all their politenesses and good manners to entertain you, and you're entertaining them." And the British consul in Fuzhou was then married to an American woman, Matty Tribe. Keith Tribe was our consul general, and he, being influenced by his wife, was entertaining the Japanese to parties, And we were all wearing our best clothes because Matty was a marvellous dressmaker and designer of clothes. So we were going to rather large parties in which the Japanese army or consular service was being rather feted by Americans and British. There he is. This was before Pearl Harbor.
Did you have any inkling at all?
No.
That there would be a war with Japan?
No. Well, we did know, I was in Shanghai when it was bombed. I knew that I, of course, was very anti-Japanese. And my husband was naturally being employed by the Chinese. And nothing would have persuaded him to be connected in any way with the Japanese. And my father, too, being pro-Chinese and the Japanese, he knew, was the military were in charge. I was horrified at this man saying to me, "Here you are, going to drag us into the next World War." I was quite disgusted with him. Ed Rice, I never knew his name. He was the consul. And I told Gordon when he came back. But he said, I have to go around the coast and inspect the salt-producing... places in the south of Fujian, and I'm going to take everything with me. I'm going to take my camp bed and 10 salt police and my cook and everything, all the cooking utensils I want, and all the food I want. And he went off for an inspection tour of 2 weeks. Well, I was alone in the house, and I was rather a silly person. I didn't get anybody to come and live with me at that time. I didn't know enough people, I suppose, I didn't know how to enough Chinese to put things in motion. However, Gordon went off with this large expedition on safari, which he loved doing. He loved inspecting the coast. And they began to be bombed. And as they were going along, he decided he'd have to go across the river with all his possessions. I think it was more a canal or a creek or something. It may not have been a river. But as he came to the opposite bank, a whole lot of bandits came from behind a temple where they'd been hiding, waiting for this boat to come in. And they set upon this, including my husband, and robbed them everything, the bed and all the cooking utensils and the camera and the field glasses and all the rest that he had with him. And Gordon said he didn't know what on earth was going to happen because they were surrounded by evil Chinese bandits. I mean, they were men who were waiting to rob anybody. Well, the Reuter message that went out from Fu Cha was, Gordon Pearson captured by Japanese. Well, of course, they weren't. The Japanese were watching this from the air. And Gordon was led up a hill by himself with a pistol behind his back. And then one of the salt police came and told me that the last they saw of Gordon Pearson, that was he was being led up a hill with a pistol behind his back. So I went through tortures, you see. And we had this stupid British consul, Keith Tribe, who came to me and he said, oh, well, Myrtle, are you ready to pay a ransom for your husband's release? So I said, I have no money, I've got nothing. I know that the salt interests have got lots of money, but I have no money. Oh, he said, they'll be sending you fingers or an ear or something to say that they really want money. And they'll have. I mean, this man was supposed to be our senior British citizen there, but he was putting me through it like anything. However, we had no news of him, Gordon, at all. He had turned up in a week, having walked from this place in South China across the hills and stopped at various villages, and came in with a full beard and his cook. And all the salt police, of course, had escaped somewhere else. But he was really saved by the Japanese, because the Japanese were so curious at what this little posse of people were doing. They were dividing up Gordon's possessions, you see, and the only thing that was left, which they didn't find, was his gold watch in his pocket. However, he got back quite safely. But it was touch and go, and all the messages were that he'd been captured by Japanese, that he was captured actually by Chinese, but saved by the Japanese. And the funny thing was,
how did they save him, the Japanese? By sort of intervening?
No, they came and zoomed down on this group. And Gordon said to his cook, we'll make a dash for it. And he ran away and hid behind something, and the Japanese were dividing up the things, you see. And the bandits were dividing up the things and took their eyes off their prisoners at the moment. So Gordon was released with his cook. Fortunately, he got back, you see. But the whole business was so muddled at that time that the Japanese were our greatest friends, because our consul went to the Japanese and said, all these things have been stolen from Mr. Pearson, who was on Chinese government service, and they would probably be in the nearest market, because the bandits won't know what to do with Chen Lijing binoculars and camera and so on. And so we'd probably be able to buy them back at the market, and that's what happened. So I've still got the camera that Gordon had when he was on that expedition. But I gave the binoculars, I've always felt they were very historic, to my nephew, who knew Gordon quite well.
It seems a very confused situation, doesn't it?
Yes.
The fact that the Japanese, your husband was working for the nationalist government.
Yes.
And yet the Japanese were sort of helping
yes.
him. Yes.
Oh, at that time, you see, Pearl Harbor hadn't happened.
That's right, yes.
And December, it was the 9th of December, the news went out that the Japanese Air Force had bombed Pearl Harbor. And then, of course, the sleeping giant of America was aroused at last. Not because we dragged them in, because they had been attacked by the Japanese.
Yes. Do you remember your reaction to...
I was so horrified because I'd heard that Singapore had been captured by the Japanese. And it was. Because, you see, they immediately bombed all our battleships, the Pulse and the Prince of Wales.
Did you hear of that?
Because the consul had a son in the Prince of Wales, and he drowned the whole crew. All those young men, you see, 400 of them went down because of the Japanese, and the Repulse. I've forgotten the other. There were three, I think, big battleships. And Duff Cooper had just been made Minister of Defence, and that was what he had to go and inspect. He went by air to Singapore and found that when he got there, the might of the British Navy had gone down by the Japanese, because they, by air, they attacked them. We thought they were coming in. We had all our guns poised for the Japanese to come in by sea in their battleships. And that's why we sent battleships out.
Was it a big shock, do you think, when that happened?
But it was like the shock that went round the world when Pearl Harbor was bombed. I don't know whether you remember it yourself. I'm sorry about so. You see, I was then in my late 30s. I think I was 38 when I was in Fujian. And when I went to a party, I said to Mattie Tribe, this American woman, who had been very pro-Japanese, oh, she'd been dancing with the Japanese consul. She said, I think he's very nice. I think I'm going to have an affair with him. I said, good heavens, Mattie, but they're our enemies. You can't go entertaining them. She was a terribly worldly person, and she loved a good time. And she was inviting all the Japanese high-ups. Oh, she said, but directly, of course, Pearl Harbor came, they had to be on the side of the Americans. They couldn't. I mean, the Americans didn't realize how near disaster they were. And the Japanese had planned it so well. It was a Sunday, wasn't it, Pearl Harbor? And they were all on leave or something. Everything went down there in Pearl Harbor. The cream of the American Navy.
Yes. Was it a very great shock, the whole thing? You know, Pearl Harbor and then the fall of Singapore.
It was in Hong Kong, because everybody became a prisoner there.
Well, I wonder about yourself, you see.
Myself?
I can only...
No, not with me, because I felt we were protected by the Chinese government. We could always evacuate to Yunnan, even. We went back to Yunnan by road.
Did you, right away?
Yeah. No, not right away. We heard that the Japanese are coming in. They're not only going to steal things from the Chinese, but they were going to take over the whole of Fujian province. So Gordon said, you better go out by air to Yunnan and wait for me there, because I shall eventually have to be evacuated, because they don't want me in the hands of the Japanese. So he came by air via Chongqing. He had to report in Chongqing first, and then he came to Kunming after me. And we used to correspond entirely by telegram, and we had a secret code. I mean, we made up a code of all the capitals of the world meant certain things. And if we had three words, that was enough to give the information we wanted to send. We had a proper worked-out code, which nobody else had. He had one copy and I had the other. So if we said Waterloo, Manchester, so and so, we'd look up our code and just piece it out. Because I was quite used by now of reading Gordon's cables from different parts. The telegraph service was very good in China. Anything that they did was excellent. I mean, their railways are marvellous, modelled on our British railways. And they had engineers from England, you see, to build them. And their railway system from Shanghai to Peking was like the Marco Polo road from Peking to the Yangtze and below.
When the Japanese took over, they took over most of the rail routes, didn't they, along the
They took over
the
everything.
Coast, yes.
And the only part they couldn't get into was this mountainous part in the west of China. That's why they could never get to Yunnan. They
yes.
could bomb Yunnan, which they did. And as I said, they were instrumental in killing one of my friends, Pollard Urquhart, who died of blood poisoning because he didn't look after himself properly. That wasn't the Japanese fault, that was his own silly fault.
Yes. When did your husband come back to Kunming? Or Chongqing?
When I left in 1941, I went to Kunming, and I knew I could get money because there was a salt office there. And Gordon said, if you're hard up for money, go to the salt office. But I didn't want to be entirely dependent on the salt. So I went to the British consulate, and I said, here I am, a refugee from East China, from Fujian. Can I do any war work? And they said, oh, well, you can go to the spy hole. So I said, what do you mean? Oh, there's a journalist here who is watching events in West China, and you can go and be in his office. So I said, well, I don't think so. I'm not very good at keeping secrets. I think I should probably tell the wrong person a bit of news that he wanted to keep secret. I said, I'm no good at taking oaths to be a spy and not saying anything of what I've seen. A bit of a chatterbox. Oh, they said, you don't want to go and live in that house. Oh, have a nice time, you know, they have all the British things, marmalade and lovely things. So I said, no, I don't really want to work with five other people. Isn't it some teaching work you can give me? Oh, one man said in the consulate, Professor Shui came in. He wanted somebody for his college. Oh, yes, you better go and see whether the job's still open. And I went, and of course, from then on, Shui became my greatest friend. He had been in Peking with Pollard Urquhart, who is no longer there. And, he said, that's marvellous, sir. You can take my classes for me at 8:30 in the morning. I said, no, not 8:30 in the morning. They begin very early in China. That's why I always wake up at 6:00 every morning. I can't get out of the habit. And he said, well, I'll take the first classes. You can take the 9 to 10 classes. So I worked with him for 5 years and was co-opted by the British Council. Now, Shui was a teacher born. Well, he's one of these marvellous people. He said, I want girls in my college. I don't care what the men do. As long as I can educate the girls, I don't mind.
These would have been Chinese girls.
Entirely Chinese. This we were now living in a Chinese city.
Would these, the Chinese in... This is Chongqing.
This is Kunming.
But you're still in Kunming.
Yes.
Yes.
I didn't live in Chongqing
yes,
at all.
You didn't, no. Would these have been... refugees,
yes,
some
mostly.
From the
east.
Yes.
All the five, Peking, there were three universities from Peking in Kunming, or, you know, they were partially, they had come either walking or by air or by truck to Kunming to be out of the bombing areas. And they had set up their own campuses. So sometimes you would be asked by one of the universities, the Yundao had, of course, already had a university, a Yunnan University. And Miss Harris, who was who came after me to Kunming, was asked to take a course in world literature. And she said, good heavens, I don't know what to do. She had partly done this Chinese training, but she didn't know very much about world literature. So I said, well, I'll do part of it and you'll do part of it. And Shui said to me, do you know Cervantes? So I said, I've read John Quixote. Oh, yes, he says you can do a course on... And I had to begin reading world classics. That was the course, world classics.
But more the war sort of period.
Well, the whole idea was that at English College, that Yunnan was one of the most beautiful and it had been a place of exile. It was the furthest place they could possibly have from Peking. And it's been settled by people who had the Peking dialect, and so everybody in Yunnan spoke standard Chinese. Only a few words were local words, like wah-wah for baby and other words that you got to know in time. But Yunnan had been a place of exile, and only people who had been banished from the courts of Peking were there. They were provincial governors who had got into scrapes for some reason or other. And so there was a tremendous amount of treasure in Yunnan, which was collected from every province of China, and they were all speaking Peking dialect. And so when Gordon found that he was posted to Yunnan, he was absolutely thrilled, because everybody spoke in the dialect he understood, because they had all come from other parts of China. And really, it was a kingdom on its own. It was cut off because of the mountains. It was cut off because of its history and culture. And so he was happy. I was happy because I was with Shui, who spoke Peking, and I got to know a little bit more about the language. I hadn't been very successful in learning a great deal. But Shui was a real Anglophile. He absolutely loved English literature, and he was founding a school that was called the English College, and he was on his own outside the university. But we had to go every week to give our lectures at the university, and then we used to have our regular lectures and classes in the English College.
I wonder how far the war impinged on you.
Yes.
You know, were you bombed after this?
No, no, we weren't being bombed then. This part was very interesting from this point of view. The communists were infiltrating into the whole of China. Now, you must remember that this was still under Chiang Kai-shek, and the provincial governors were still paying tribute to Chiang Kai-shek and sending the money to him. Suddenly, I found that some of the best students in the class were disappearing. And I said to Gordon, while you're inspecting those landmines, would you go to a certain place called Paoshan or whatever it was that I wanted him to go to, because one of our best students has gone there. And Gordon sent me a letter. He said, well, I went to that country place that you asked me to go to, and I found I was being surrounded by communists, because I heard communist songs being sung in all the buildings around. And that was a special training ground for taking over Kunming when the time came. And they knew all the students, you see, and they picked out the most intelligent. Even amongst your servants, the best servants, used to go to these schools, and they were being trained in taking over banks or hospitals or restaurants or anything that needs to be organized. These people were being trained in that particular way, and they were being taught songs, because they said, if you teach the ordinary people a song or a hymn, that'll make a unity amongst them, and we want them all to be Chinese and obedient, you see. They begin to organize. That is really what Mao did, was to organise.
So it would seem, you know, one gets the impression that the communists were blockaded in the north, but you are implying that they were...
They were infiltrating into the whole of China because, you see, the Chinese were ready for change, and Shui, who was up in the... He went from Yunnan to his father in the north, who was the Minister of Education, and we went with him after my husband died. My husband died in a hospital down the China, after an inspection tour.
What date was that?
That was 1948. He went on an expedition where the trucks were being fueled by charcoal and they were breaking down, and he said that he wasn't going to trust himself to those awful breaks. They didn't have the trucks in good repair, and he would walk part of the way. And part of these valleys in Yunnan were full of malarial mosquitoes, and while he was picking raspberries or whatever fruit there was growing in the side of the road, he would be stung by these mosquitoes, and though he had been inoculated against malaria, he got a form of malaria that nobody had ever met before, and he got malaria, and then he had to live in an engineer's hut at the side of the road, and the water hadn't been properly boiled, because you have to boil water a long time when you're at a great height. And he must have drunk some water, which gave him typhoid. So he, by the time he reached Baoshan, where the end of his journey came, he found that he had a fever of some sort and had to go to the Canadian hospital, which had been built specially for the workers on the road. You see, it was a missionary hospital, and missionaries from all parts of Canada had come as volunteers to help in this hospital. So you had a complete hospital with trained doctors, and Gordon had to go into hospital, and I was sent for in Kunming to go down to this place, Baoshan, and be with Gordon because he was very ill. And that was where he died in 1948.